in response tabled a document which appeared to be put together very quickly in response to, you know, I guess something that they thought wouldn't take place, having the Mosquito delegation be very well prepared in what they wanted. But that response spoke in terms of ethnic groups. Okay, they couldn't bring themselves to say indigenous people or Indian peoples, but were using the term ethnic groups. And on the second day, Mr. Rivera decided that if anything, at least he would come out of this conference or this negotiations with the government recognizing them as indigenous peoples, although he was advised that don't worry about what they call you, just get your rights, then you work on, you know, on who you are. But his statement was, well, if they don't even accept us or recognize us as Indian peoples, how can we expect them to agree to Indian rights? So in the end, in the final analysis, there was a communique which set out another meeting date and thanked the observers that were there, the representatives of six countries and the World Council of Indigenous Peoples, and did refer to the Mosquito as basically indigenous. So that, in a sense, was a slight victory. The accord that was tabled was very comprehensive. It set out the aspirations of the Mosquito people as represented by Ms. Urasata, and was to have been one accord of hopefully several accords that would, in the end analysis, lead to a treaty between the Mosquito Indians and the Sandinista government. And again, Ms. Urasata made it clear that their objective is not to overthrow the government, but to win their rights within the current sovereignty of the Sandinista government, or of the government of Nicaragua, but with a clear recognition of land rights and a form of autonomy which they were proposing in the accord. They were also talking in terms of that treaty eventually getting recognition and the protection of the proposed new constitution of the government of Nicaragua. So in a sense, not only was it peace talks, which would end up in a treaty, but also would become protected by the constitution. So in a sense, it was also also the start of a process of constitutional negotiation between the Mosquito Indians and the government of Nicaragua. I had an opportunity to speak to Mr. Carillon again on the second day, and his statement at that time was, well, yes, we're still willing to recognize Indian rights and to recognize some form of autonomy, but we really don't know what it means. What does Aboriginal rights mean? Because Brooklyn as well, when he was talking, was saying, we as Indian peoples have the Aboriginal rights, you know, to our land and to some form of autonomy or self-government. So Carillon's statement was, well, we are going to negotiate again, the process will continue, but in the meantime, this will give us an opportunity to consult with anthropologists as to what Aboriginal rights means. And this is not a put down with respect to anthropologists, but this was his comments to me. And I said, well, that's fine, but at the same time, I said, you should consult with others, and particularly with the World Council of Indigenous Peoples. I told him, as I told Brooklyn, that the World Council is available to give advice to both Indigenous peoples and to governments with respect to the rights of Indigenous peoples, and that we would be willing at any time to sit down with the government of Nicaragua and advise them on Indian rights, and that in fact other countries have gone through processes of negotiation and have dealt with the issue of Aboriginal rights, and that we had some expertise and had people that had expertise in the area, and we would be more than willing to help. He said, fine, that's very good. We accept that, but we have yet to hear from them to, in fact, engage us in that kind of exercise. So that movement in Nicaragua is taking place, but part of the accord that Brooklyn put forward was to have a three-month ceasefire beginning about the middle of January. And that didn't come about. There was no ceasefire, and I think the violence escalated over the latter part of December and first part of January, so the peace talks did not go ahead as scheduled, but there is movement now to set another date. But of course, as I mentioned earlier, there are political forces out to destroy that. The meeting in Colombia, not in Colombia, the meeting in Honduras, which was meant to be a meeting between the Mosquito leaders. Well, I should mention that there are currently three organizations representing the Mosquito people. Misura Sata, which is based in Costa Rica and is a revolutionary movement, a liberation movement. Then you have Misura, which is an organization which broke off of Misura Sata and joined the counter-revolutionaries who are in Honduras. And their stated objective, of course, along with the counter-revolutionaries, is to overthrow the government. And within the country, there is an organization known as MISATAN, which was formed in July. MISATAN has the cooperation of the government and, in fact, was represented at our Panama meeting in September through CORPI, the regional member of the World Council of Indigenous Peoples. So you have those three organizations representing the Mosquito people. Now, we feel relatively secure, or at least I do, that Misura Sata has the popular support of the Mosquito in the Atlantic coast. Brooklyn Rivera did take a trip through the Atlantic coast in October, and from the evidence of photographs and reports, the trip of Brooklyn was very well received. The people did want to see some form of autonomy, did want to return to their communities, and did want to see reunification, and would be more than happy to live within the context of the Nicaraguan state, but with protected rights. So the meeting in Honduras was, sidetracked by the action of the Misura organization along with the counter-revolutionaries putting pressure on the Honduran government. So the Mosquito leaders, Misura Sata leaders, when they arrived, were arrested, held for 24 hours incommunicado, then sent back to Costa Rica. So they're trying to frustrate any possibility of the Mosquito leaders currently in Honduras from joining forces and entering the peace dialogue. And there's also, Misura is also by force of arms preventing the Mosquito refugees from returning back from the Honduran refugee camps into Nicaragua. Now, we also have the situation of the Eden Pastora, who is based in Costa Rica, with which Misura Sata had been in partnership during the revolutionary struggle over the past couple of years. But there is now a break because Misura Sata wants to resolve this through the peace talks, and the Eden Pastora group does not. So while Brooklyn was in Washington in January, Eden Pastora's group called a press conference, brought two Mosquitos forward that were within Misura Sata. The conference, or the press conference, denounced the leadership of Brooklyn Rivera, stating that he's no longer the leader. Misura Sata no longer is willing to enter into peace talks with the Sandinista governments. Brooklyn Rivera is a communist. So Brooklyn Rivera has had to work after that to again repair his image and the image of Misura Sata, and to ensure that the peace talks will go ahead. And we are now told that the talks will go ahead as soon as a date can be set and the whole peace talks can again continue. But there are forces from all sectors trying to make that impossible. So it's a difficult situation. Other countries are facing similar difficulties. Again, this left and right struggle is predominant throughout South America as well. One situation is in Peru, where the Indian leadership has been government on the basis that they're sympathizers and collaborators with the Shining Path guerrilla movement. And on the other hand, that same leadership is getting death threats, letters of death threats from the Shining Path, stating that if they don't join the left movement, they will be executed. So, you know, the Indians are caught in that kind of situation. So it's very, very difficult. I myself will be traveling back to Central America this spring, and as well hope to spend about 2 months in South America next November, December. So I want to learn more. I can't, again, say that I'm an expert, but there is a lot of work that has to be done. And with respect to I guess, why I'm here, I think those things that are true in South and Central America are to a degree true in North America. But here, at least in the Americas, we have the opportunity to put into place institutions that reflect indigenous thought and philosophy. And I guess this is where the conflict is taking place, from what I understand from the discussion yesterday, that seems to be more more of an issue in Canada or in the United States. I think what we're seeing here is whether the form of a settlement or negotiation between the indigenous peoples and the state is in the best interest of the indigenous peoples. And I guess one has to look at the issue of, you know, what is best for the people on the terms of what the people themselves feel is best for themselves. The institutions that were set up under the Native Alaska Review Commission, of course, is something that people have had an experience with over the past, was it 10 years or so, 15 years, I'm not fully aware, but now is the time for re-examination of that. I think in the end, people will have to decide what is best for themselves based on, you know, the environment, the culture, and the degree that the indigenous peoples want to remain as such, as indigenous peoples, but incorporating the tools of technology. And I guess in the final analysis, this will have to be determined by the community peoples themselves, possibly with finding some common ground somewhere between the two extremes of being primitive to being, I suppose, a total technological society that does away with any kind of indigenous thought or philosophy. I hope to be able to express that maybe a little bit more later during the discussion with respect to specifics, but I guess that basically is my response to the question brought earlier. I'm trying to tie it all together so I don't have to give a statement later. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Clem. That most complete analysis of events in Nicaragua, and we're grateful to you for it. Perhaps we could move on now. Before we do, allow me to make two observations. One, the idea that the concessions to the United Fruit Company in Panama have served as the model for regional autonomy for the Indian people of that country is a fascinating idea. And when Doug Sanders pointed out that the Mosquito Indians live in a fairly isolated part of Nicaragua in 200 small villages, that made me think of Alaska, where the majority of Native people live in 200 approximately small villages, and it gave rise to the speculation that if the United States, supporting as it does the opponents of the Sandinista government, were to urge a measure of regional autonomy for those Native people in those 200 small villages, it might conceivably turn out to be useful to Alaska Natives in the future. At any rate, we will watch events unfold. Well, perhaps we might now turn to the to Moses Kaela and his hear about the situation in Hawaii. There is a great tendency, I think we all suffer from it, to talk about North and South America and indigenous peoples and forget all about the 49th state or the 50th state. I can never remember which is which. So we'll give you the floor, Moses, and just take your time and tell us your thoughts.
Okay. Thank you. Honorable Thomas Berger, distinguished fellow participants and guests, from the people of the land of Aloha, I bring greetings. I'm personally pleased to have been invited to attend this roundtable discussions. For that, my thank you to you, Mr. Berger. I've been asked questions yesterday. Why are we here? Why are the Hawaiians here? First of all, let me respond by saying we are an indigenous people to Hawaii, and we share the same faith as indigenous peoples throughout the world that have come in contact with Western society. First of all, let me give you a short history on the Office of Foreign Affairs. Native self-government, I mean specifically Hawaiian self-government, has passed through several stages since the last two centuries. Island districts were once ruled by district chiefs, and eventually individual islands came under the rule of a single chief. Power struggles, in most cases, took the form of open warfare. In the early 1800s, the islands were unified by a single person, King Kamehameha I. The Kingdom of Hawaii existed to 1893. Since that period, Hawaiian self-government, Hawaiian sovereignty, the ability to exercise political control over a specific geographic area, and the people who occupy that defined area has rapidly decreased. Post-1893 brought a provisional government composed of descendants of missionaries who taught the natives the lessons of the Old and New Testament. The provisional government was later called the Republic of Hawaii. The territorial government and statehood came to Hawaii in 1959 with the help of Alaska. By statehood, Hawaiians shared the bottom rung of the social economic ladder and exercised little, if any, political influence over native affairs. During the Constitutional Convention of 1978, the Constitutional Convention delegates proposed to the voters of the general public, who agreed to form a Constitutional Office of Hawaiian Affairs, or OHA as the office is commonly called. OHA has its legal base in the state constitution, and its implementing legislation is a part of the Hawaii Revised Statutes. Under the provisions of Chapter 10, Hawaii Revised Statutes, Hawaiians elect 9 fellow Hawaiians to serve as trustees for a 4-year term. The general purpose of OHA is to better the conditions of Hawaiians. To achieve that general overall purpose, to better the conditions of Native Hawaiians, OHA has broad powers and authority. OHA is both a corporation and a trust. As a corporation, OHA has the capacity to act as a legal unit meaning OHA has the power to hold property, to contract, to sue, and to be sued as a distinct entity. As a trust, OHA holds legal title to trust property as compared to individual shareholders. As a part of the state of Hawaii, OHA pays no federal, state, or county taxes on its income or property, as the case may be. As a vehicle for Hawaiians, OHA has many positive aspects to it. Yet compared to a kingdom, OHA has its downside. Surely, if Hawaiians still had the kingdom, we would not be here today. We would have invited you all to sunny Hawaii and paved the way there. As I explained earlier, we are made up of 9 trustees elected by a Hawaiian people. And when you have 9 elected officials to represent a body, you more than likely would have 9 different points of view expressed on that board. In being selected to head the delegation to come up here to these round tables, I was given the statement to read, to pacify, I guess, or to represent collectively, hopefully, the views of 9 people. However, I'm pleased to have 2 other trustees with me here at these round tables. And if you'd permit me, after I read these statements, I would like them to be allowed to come forward and to present their view on it, and maybe to help answer questions. Native peoples are forced with a difficult task in understanding and coming to grips with their place in Western society. A major part of this process must be a dialogue between groups of Native people, as well as within Native groups, to resolve what form that role should take. Native peoples may have a common interest in supporting one another in order to retain their culture and independent status. However, within each Native group, as well as between Native groups, there are often diverse and sometimes conflicting interests. In resolving these conflicts, one must look to the history and traditional values of Native peoples. The ancient Hawaiians were a land and ocean-based people. They viewed the land and the ocean as the source of both their spiritual and material wealth. Land was a collective resource of the people, administered and protected by the alii, or chiefs. Each segment of the population was allowed to use the land and could exercise certain rights so long as those rights were not abused and did not interfere with the rights of others. There was no concept similar to fee simple ownership. Land was held in trust by the alii for the common good, and Hawaiian society was based on the welfare of the community as a whole, and sharing work and the products of the land. Western contact resulted in the rapid disintegration of Hawaiian society, the dissolution of the kapu or tabu system, which regulated relationships among the people. The change in land tenure from communal to fee simple ownership, and the subsequent loss of native lands, the breakdown of traditional family and societal institutions, the influence of Christianity and its mores and values, the influx of foreign trade and commerce, eventually the overthrow of the native government with the aid of United States agents, annexation to the United States, a period of despair followed by largely unsuccessful efforts to integrate into mainstream American society. Only in the past 10 years, with the establishment of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, have Native Hawaiians' attempts to gain recognition as a distinct people within the general population made any headway. In modern Hawaii, Native Hawaiians are found in many different economic and social stratas, although vast majority fall at the low end of the spectrum. The only official vote of Native Hawaiians is OHA, created by the state constitution 1978 to promote the betterment of conditions of Native Hawaiians. OHA, under the direction of 9 Native trustees elected by Natives throughout the state, must consider the interests of all Native Hawaiians in making decisions impacting upon the resources and development of the Native community. Yet in making such decisions, OHA has consistently taken the position that traditional cultural values and practices of the Native people must be given greater consideration. This comes from the recognition that in the past, Native people have been given no choice. They had to conform to Western society if they hoped to survive. The biases was totally in favor of assimilation. OHA's role has been to assure that Native Hawaiians have the choice of assimilation or retaining a more traditional lifestyle. This is not an easy task, since not only private sector and other government agencies seek to promote conflicting values and have greater political and economic power, but oftentimes the interests of those Native Hawaiians who have successfully assimilated to Western society are adverse. For Native Hawaiians, and indeed for most Native peoples, there probably can be no return to earlier times. However, there can be a conscious choice to protect and ensure the survival of the spiritual and cultural values which gave traditional societies their viability and life. This should be the guiding principle in all decisions impacting upon Native peoples and their place in Western society. Thank you. At this time, I'd like to call on Moani Ke Ala Akaka and Guard Ke Aloha, if they may.
Let's just pull another chair up there.
Aloha mai. My name is Moani Ke Ala Akaka, and I'm trustee of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs from the Big Island. I'm the only newly elected trustee, as well as the fact that I'm the only woman on the board. It's not just that I'm a trustee of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, but I'm also a grassroots leader of the Protect Kaha'olawe Ohana, which is a grassroots organization that has been working to stop the bombing by the U.S. Navy on our sacred island. At our Umau Ke'ea o Ka'aina I Kapono, the life of the land is to be perpetuated in righteousness, is not only a dictate that was handed down by our King Kamehameha III, but has also been accepted as a state motto for Hawaii. As far as we're concerned, this relates to living in balance with the land, which is part of our native value system. We Hawaiians have become strangers in our own land. Over 85% of the population now makes less than $20,000 a year, and Hawaii is almost as expensive to live in as Alaska, but we don't make the kinds of wages that you do here. So we are in dire straits. We have, as I mentioned, we are strangers in our own land. We have many, many Hawaiian families that are today forced to live on the beaches of Hawaii, not by choice, but because they cannot afford the high cost of land, rents, or housing in Hawaii. A handful of us started the Hawaiian movement in a place called Kalama Valley in 1970 in Hawaii. And at that time, housing wasn't just land rights and justice for our people, but the whole aspect of housing. At that time, a state study had been made, and it proved that 80% of the population in Hawaii could not afford to buy their own home. Today, the situation is much, much worse. This is why we have a great number of our native peoples forced to live on the beach. You know, the Pope had told the Mesquite Indians of Peru a few weeks ago that you must fight for your trees, your land, and your culture. And this is some of what we're doing in Hawaii. As far as our trees are concerned, our native forests right now, our ohia forests, are now being threatened to be used as biomass for electricity. Now, I have a report here written by a botanist from the University of Hawaii, Dr. Mueller Dumbois, that points out that these native forests, this particular native forest that's being ravaged right now, is one of the world's unique forests. Ohia is endemic to Hawaii. And we feel that our native forests, it's not necessarily that we're against biomass, but they should leave our native forests alone. They're important ecosystems. It's not just the plants and endangered birds that live in this area, but it's also a source of our water. And especially on my island, we've had threats of drought for off and on for the past few years. Our value system, Waikaula, water is life. No water, no life. So this is just one indication of some of the exploitation that is going on in our islands. We talked yesterday about growth and development. One of the things that's happening right now, one of the proposals that's come about, is the mining of our seas. Now, this all came about, it started from the Law of the Sea conference that was held. It's been in negotiations were going on for about 14 years, relating to this whole issue of sharing the ocean's wealth. One of the reasons that Reagan refused to sign it a few years ago was because this whole aspect of mining of the seas. Now, right now, they're in the process of proposing to mine the ocean crust right off of some of our coastlines within the archipelago of Hawaii. Now, they're talking about mining it, strip mining the ocean. I have some leaflets here, which I'll put down on the table if you might want to go over them. But they're talking about strip mining the ocean for cobalt. Cobalt to be used in munitions, cobalt to be used for jet engines. Yet they have, from what we've been told by the Oceanic Society, they have plenty of cobalt in the continental United States. There's no reason why they should go and mess with our ocean and disturb fragile ecosystems that have never seen the light of day. And you know, possibly we have the fishing industry there, just destroying our ocean. We're island people. Fish is very, very important to us. Now, they're talking about processing these manganese crusts on the island of Hawaii where I live. Now, according to a chemist from the University of Hawaii, this kind of processing of this of these nodules is very, very polluting and is very, very cost intensive. And we, the people living on the Big Island, will be stuck with the pollution. So it's not only the pollution of our ocean that we're concerned about, but also the pollution of our land and of ourselves physically. Because we're out in the middle of the ocean, a lot of times it's out of sight, out of mind. They tried to do this same mining of the seas on the western coastline, Oregon, Washington coastline, and it was stopped a year ago. So now they're trying to do it to us. What amazes me is that the Department of Interior is coming in and talking about these exclusive economic zones which extend out 200 miles. Now, they refer to Hawaii as their outer continental shelf. The United States of America is over 2,000 miles away, yet they have the nerve to call us their outer continental shelf, especially in the view of the fact that they're talking about leasing out our ocean floor when they haven't even acknowledged that they have stolen our whole country and that we native peoples are strangers in our own land. We object to these kinds of industries. We are not against, we are against polluting industries that may destroy our quality of life. We destroy our living imbalance, as is native tradition, with our land and our ocean. The ocean to us is like our refrigerator. Our fish, our food comes from there. We're island people, as I'd mentioned. The ocean is, it's very, very important to us that the ocean is non-polluting. The waste from these manganese nodules, these manganese crusts, they plan to dump off of the coastline of my island in a 3-mile-long trench, a 3-mile-deep, 25-mile-long trench, the mouth of which comes right, empties right by Hilo, which is the capital of our island anyway. And these highly lethal toxic wastes, 97% waste, are of thallium, arsenic, and lead. Thallium, which a chemist told me is enough on a pinpoint head, is enough to kill you. Yet they're talking about 576,000 pounds of thallium, 756,000 pounds of arsenic, and a million pounds of lead, and dumping that into our ocean, which means in the next 10 or 15 or 20 years, that will be cancer for we and our families. So we are against this kind of development and exploitation, and feel that the United States has the audacity to call that their outer continental shelf. There's also a move, like with your situation, to deplete our land base. Right now we're in the process of, first of all, in 1978, the Hilo Airport on my island is on Hawaiian reservation land. That people were, families were moved off of that land to make way for an airport runway, of which we were never compensated for. In 1978, we tried to have negotiations with the state to pay rent, as well as the fact that there was a court case in process for the state to pay rent for our reservation lands that airport runway was on. As a result of our closing down the airport in 1978, over $500,000 a year has been coming into the Department of Hawaiian Homes lands, which is our Hawaiian reservation lands, for the past few years as a result of our being at the Hilo Airport in 1978. Within the past few months, there is a move in the state to trade these airport lands for other lands over in Oahu. We're talking about trading 204 acres of land for 13 acres of industrial land, of which they're telling us that this is an equal trade. And although we would be making, to begin with, half of what we're getting for the airport now, there are illusions of promises of speculation and increases of rental coming up in the 1987, 1990, and 2007. We feel that this is a number of people in the community feel this is a very, very unfair trade and really not in the best interest of the Hawaiian people and the beginning of the state beginning to erode our ceded land resources. We have two land bases, the ceded land resources, lands that were ceded over when the United States took Hawaii over. They took over these lands, and when we became a state, these lands, 1.5 million acres of ceded lands, were given to the state to hold in trust for we, the Hawaiian people, and the general public. Of those ceded lands, the Office of Hawaiian Affairs is supposed to be collecting 20% of the resources. As I'd mentioned, it's not necessarily that we're against development, but we're against development that is not in keeping with our land, in keeping and in balance with our land. And also, let's face it, a lot of polluting mistakes have already been made on the lower in the lower 48. And we in Hawaii want to make sure that the same kind of polluting decisions do not come to our homeland. What we're saying is learn from the mistakes that you've made before in the past. So I would like to end by saying that I think that it is our responsibility to help to support Native struggles wherever they may be. They've been in meeting with Indians and with Alaskans and with other Native peoples, we find that we have many, many commonalities, much less some of our ancestors had even, it's been proven, had even come up this coastline by canoe generations and generations ago. And I've met a number of Alaskans that also have some Hawaiian blood in them. So what we try to tell the rest of the natives in the South Pacific is don't make the same kinds of mistakes that have been made in Hawaii and that have been allowed to be made in Hawaii. And I'm hoping that we can learn from each other's mistakes so that we may go forward as Native peoples and help our people maintain the position of dignity so that they may survive and not be strangers in their own homelands. Mahalo.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Guard Kealoha.
Thank you. I've lost my voice and I shall try to speak more clearly. I want to also say mahalo, my appreciation for your invitation to join this discussion and to say also aloha to all of you here today. Mr. Keawe told you that there were 9 trustees that formed the governing board for OHA that vary in their ideas in approaches to problem solving, but we are tied together by a common heritage and blood. Before I get into my reaction to some of yesterday's discussion, I should give you a little bit more information about Native Hawaiians. There are about 170,000 of us in the state of Hawaii, almost as many in the state of California. 50% of that population is 19 years of age and under. 48,000 live at U.S. poverty level designations, 24,000 unemployed. So we have, from just those bare statistics, some very real problems address the social and economic self-sufficiency of Native Hawaiian people. I also happen to work for a private nonprofit community-based Hawaiian organization that is a grantee of the Administration for Native Americans. I know some of you are familiar with that. It's called Alulike, and it was recently designated the number one grantee in the nation by the Assistant Secretary for Health and Human Services. Yesterday's discussion brought some interesting ideas to mind when I heard some of you talk, and one was the gentleman who referred to the cosmology of the South American peoples. And I thought that it wasn't until 30 years I was 30 years old, I'm now nearing 50, but when I was about 30, I was able to learn more about the creation chant of the Kumulipo, the Hawaiian account of the creation. And it was fascinating to me to learn that the Hawaiians began with slime and the dark and were able to classify everything under the ocean seen with the naked eye, as well as everything on land and their counterparts, so that they were able to see an evolution long before Darwin came across that idea, which gave me an idea of how excellent the Hawaiian intellect was. That the words for water, there were at least 100 definitions for water, that they named every star seen with the naked eye, that they had an understanding, an intimate relationship with land and sea, that they weren't indeed blown to Hawaii, that they knew that they were going where they were going, and that they were at home on both the land and the sea, on a vast Pacific, navigating long before Eric the Red, without sextant or compass, and Columbus's discovery, rediscovery, whatever you call it. Mrs. Worrell talked yesterday, too, about the conflict of values and attitudes and how difficult it was sometimes to define the solutions that occur when these conflicts and when these values seem so at odds. That the persistent evidence, however, and the most visible, perhaps, for us is in our public education system. According to a needs assessment conducted by my Aloliki agency, and is now also being reassessed by OHA in a new needs, in an upgrading of the needs assessment. Hawaiians place education as their priority. And I will discuss that in more detail later. Mr. Professor Hank's comments on de las casas was very new to me. It was new information. And I appreciated your comments on the accommodation, on the realistic kinds of things that we have to do in 1985 and the future in order to perhaps protect our own unique identities and our own special ways of dealing with life. Native Hawaiians face challenges that unless met with a sense of learning bicultural ways will diminish our own ability to malama, what we say malama, or take care of our own resources. The excellence of the legacy that I learned about, the Native Hawaiians' contributions in terms of navigational skills and their cosmology, made me realize that I think once our children know that heritage, they should be willing to fly spaceships. They should be willing to man them. They should be willing to go into new areas of man's creativity with confidence, because they can bring that sense of values and attitudes that Mrs. Ward was worried about and combine them in a pluralistic society so that it can become an even more enhanced and rich life. That's my own personal view about the values that we need to maintain and keep. Moani talked earlier about some of our resources that were diminishing. We have let me tell you a little bit about our aristocracy. The last queen, after her overthrow, gathered what she had left in terms of personal property and left that to be invested so that revenues would put aside for to benefit the indigent and orphaned poor children. Today we have the Queen Liliʻu ʻokelani Children's Center. King Lunalila, when he died, left all of his property for the establishment and endowment of a retirement home, a home for the aged, the elderly, the kupuna, from where we draw, like many of you do, your source of your lore, the source of your culture. The last princess in the Kamehameha dynasty left all of her lands, the revenues of which were to establish a school for Hawaiian children. Those lands comprise about 8% of the total state lands, and a small percentage of it is invested in lease residential properties. The idea of leased property is not